I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This episode of The Speakeasy has been brought to you by New York Cider Week. For more information, check out ciderweeknyc.com.
This is Michael Harlan Turkel, host of The Food Scene. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll load. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues that Sam is gonna get you some in the end.
Welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm your host, Damon Bolte. There are two things in my life that I really wish I got to do a lot more of. One of them is travel for work, and the other one is meet fellow Okies. And a few years back, I got to take care of both of those in one sweet trip to France. And in the airport, I met a fellow who I followed his writing and his articles about cocktails and mixology on his website, the Cocktail Chronicles, and then later on in Imbibe Magazine. And it wasn't until we'd met up in the airport and started driving out to Cognac, met in Bordeaux, started driving out to Cognac, we started talking about stuff and, kind of talking shop, and then realized we're both from Oklahoma. And that was kind of a weird thing to experience, you know, cocktail people from Oklahoma. But that's kind of how we started our conversation and our relationship. And I'm really happy to finally have on the show today, although via telephone, which is totally okay. Very happy to have Mr. Paul Clark in the radio waves today. Paul, how you doing, buddy?
Great. I'm really happy to be here. I wish I was there in the studio with you, Damon.
Yeah, me too, man. I don't get to see you as much as I'd like to, but it's always a good time whenever I do see you and get a chance to talk
Absolutely.
To you. Absolutely. So are you in Seattle right now?
I am in Seattle right now. We're gearing down on the January issue of Imbibe and just getting ready for the holidays coming up.
That's right. You're a very busy man. You recently came out with, outside of being the executive editor of, in my opinion, the best drinks publication out there. You've got the new book coming in, like, that came out, and you're just bouncing around. I kind of like modeled this show based on Imbibe Magazine.
Because, really?
Yeah. Because there are times where I'll have, you know, someone who is a coffee roaster or tea producer or a brewer or a winemaker. You know, it's all about drinks and not just about cocktails and spirits, you know. And I think I've had people come on and talk about non-alcoholic drinks, you know, mocktails, if you will. It's kind of based on the format of Imbibe Magazine. So I really appreciate that from you guys for inspiring this show. Also,
absolutely. And as you discovered from, you know, following this path yourself, the beverage world is this big, wild, wide-ranging place. I first kind of got my interest in it first as a beer geek years and years ago. I then kind of got into the cocktail world, and that's what got me doing this professionally. But, you know, working at Imbibe has really kind of given me an opportunity to indulge some of those other areas that I may not have, spent as much time on. Mm-hmm. I spend a lot more time thinking about and talking about and writing about coffee now, or I'm finally, kind of getting the wine education that is handy for, you know, a civilized person to have. So it's really kind of, you know, given me an opportunity to dig into these other things as well as, you know, indulge my my original passion for beer and cocktails and for great spirits. So, you know, it's just a lot of fun all around. I'm sure you're probably finding that too.
Absolutely. I mean, there's always, you know, like right now it's Sherry Week, so I've learned so much more about sherry than I have ever done from any reading, just by like going through and like kind of like mostly like a refresher course. But there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of stuff that, you know, I would say that this industry is really exciting because you can never know it all, and that kind of keeps you driven to learn more. And yeah, I learned a lot about sherry. I'm still learning about sherry. I'm not doing it right now at this particular moment. I'm enjoying a ice cold Budweiser, but but it's the sherry of I don't know which sherry it would be, but yeah, of course, you know, it's like you, as best as anyone would know a lot more about that. You know, especially like, you know, like you're saying, you've learned so much about coffee and wine. There's like, I think that's one of the coolest things about Imbibe to me too. It's like, it's not just about the, like I said before, it's not about the cocktails and spirits. It really covers everything. And even to like barwares and brewing wares and like the, you know, equipment and kind of like the offshoots and like kind of the nebulous, you know, surrounding these different tipples, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, the thing about Imbibe and Imbibe readers is really, you know, our readership is kind of a target rich environment in a way. You know, we know that we have a lot of cocktail people who pick up the magazine and read it, whether they're inside the industry as bartenders or as spirits experts or brand ambassadors or people who just really enjoy knowing more about the drink in their hands. Likewise, you know, we know we have a lot of coffee people who pick up the magazine and ditto with beer people. So as I'm going into stories and as we're going through preparing each issue, I'm kind of looking at each issue thinking, okay, how do we pull somebody out of the other camp? You know, how do we put together a beer story that's going to get the attention of that person who picked up the magazine to read about coffee? And how can we do a cocktail story that will win a beer nerd over and get them mixing something? So, you know, we have this built-in audience that is just so enthusiastic about different elements of the drinks world. And so to the extent that we can, you know, get people to kind of cross-pollinate between the different drink styles, then I think it's going to be just a richer experience for all of us. You know, the restaurant experience is going to be richer, the bar experience is going to be more wonderful, and people are just going to really enjoy what's in their glass a lot more.
I think it's, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think it's really cool, especially, you know, like you're saying, you know, there's a lot of us like nerds out there that, you know, it's easy for us to cross pollinate because anything that you can pour into a glass, we're pretty excited about it. You know, just like the technique, the process, you know, the history. But it's really cool with like magazines like Imbibe because it's not, to me, it's a great magazine to cross pollinate to the food world too. You know, like that's a huge, huge step. Whereas, you know, there are other great, you know, Bon Appetit's been really focusing more on putting more drinks into the magazine than they were, say, like 5 years ago. There are more publications that are trying to cover it all. But like, I think where Imbibe really, where it really shines is that it's almost like the master's course, you know, like it's like, you know, a fair amount about your food and beverage, but then it's like, all right, well, we're going to really like hone into this whole side and just really, really drive it, you know, and really bring it out.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, you know, we're at this really kind of unique juncture in the culinary world overall. And I think when Imbibe first came out almost 10 years ago, we'll be celebrating our 10th anniversary next year.
Congratulations.
When we first came out, you know, it was at a point where, you know, as you said, the food world it was really just on fire. People were rediscovering taste, rediscovering local ingredients, rediscovering the beauty that can be found in their kitchens and in their fields. But the drink scene overall seemed to be lagging a little bit behind. I mean, beer had picked up some, wine was certainly picking up, and cocktails were just starting to really kind of catch fire at that point. Now, 10 years later, we're at a point where we're have this fully established drinks universe. The cocktail scene is you know, we're deep into the second golden age of the cocktail in terms of creativity and innovation and inspiration. The American beer scene and the craft beer scene globally is venturing into these new territories of sour beers, of wild fermented beers, things that are absolutely phenomenal. And the coffee situation, oh my goodness, you know, when you look at what's going on in coffee houses and with independent roasters, we're seeing some really remarkable progress and really some remarkable coffees coming out. So we're at this point now where the drink scene seems to be driving a lot of the culinary conversation, which is a great place to be. And so to the point that we can, you know, give that coffee enthusiast, you know, something new to look for, something interesting to consider. Likewise, if we can get a beer person, you know, thinking a little bit more about sour beers or thinking, you know, what does the term craft mean and how does that affect our drinking life, then, you know, we're helping to be not only be a part of that conversation, but kind of drive the drinks conversation.
Do you think, you had mentioned that obviously the kind of like the food movement had started, you know, a few decades back, you know, where we actually started caring about, you know, like, I'm not bashing on, you know, like meatloaf and baked potatoes, but we started looking at food as an art form and started looking at classic techniques, and it started, that had been going on, but it really came to the foreground. And like, of course, like you said, like then wine was kind of, wine ran a little bit tandem with that, but then like beer and, you know, of course cocktails kind of came last. Do you see much of, like, speaking of food and cocktails, do you see a lot of like food and cocktail pairings out there these days, or do you still see it as like kind of exclusively like food and wine and then cocktails?
Right. Well, you know, I think key to it was we rediscovered taste, things that tasted good and things that tasted different. You know, we used to have very kind of uniform palates, and now that's just kind of, you know, gone supernova in terms of the kind of varieties of flavors that we're looking for. And to your question, you know, cocktail pairings with food, I think what we're seeing more now is not necessarily, you know, cocktail pairings as part of a dinner or as part of a restaurant plan, but where bars are really ramping up their kitchens. So they will have small plates coming out, things coming out of the kitchen that are designed to really function wonderfully as bar food. You know, you have places like Cannon here in Seattle that has an absolutely fantastic kitchen. I know Grand Army has a fantastic kitchen as well. You know, you're seeing a number of places that are really, you know, the food is no longer just kind of the thing to keep people sitting there and ordering another drink. It's something that's really delivering on its own merits and bringing people in, you know, for that reason as well.
I think you're absolutely right, especially with it being, like, you know, Sherry Week. We were talking about this a couple days ago about how, you know, the tapas culture, you know, really was born out of, rather than having a drink that pairs well with your food, it was like the food following the sherry. And I think that's really interesting, like the way you put it just now, because yeah, you're definitely right. You know, a lot of people don't realize that Death & Company has a kitchen, you know. It's kind of, yeah. It's crazy. I've had so many of those, like grilled asparagus dishes. It's insane. But yeah, you're right. I mean, like places like Mother of Pearl here as well, like, you know, like even like a lot of people argue that cocktails and food aren't necessarily supposed to go together, based on the fact that, like, all right, this cocktail is kind of like a dish on its own, and you're pairing a dish with another dish, essentially. So I don't necessarily agree with that. I think there's harmony to be found with cocktails and food as well.
Exactly. And I think in part of the way that we're looking at it is in the way that things are served. You know, the food that goes great with cocktails tends to be almost cocktail-sized food, you know, something that, sure, you can have in a couple of bites and then move on. It matches very well, has those very kind of particular flavors that merge well with the cocktail, and then you move on to something else.
Right. It's not like the steakhouse vibe where, like, all right, I'm going to, you know, well, I don't know. I've definitely had a few Manhattans while I've had a big steak, but you know what I mean.
Yeah,
you're not going
to
have like a zombie
experience as well. Sure.
Yeah. Definitely not like slamming zombies while you're eating at Peter Luger's. But you know, it's. But yeah, I mean, like you're absolutely right. I think that the idea of food with a drink, it's food with a drink, not drinks with the food. I think that's It's a really beautiful thing too. Also, it just opens up the conversation. I you know, like the vibe and the atmosphere of what you're doing. You're at a bar. You're having some drinks with friends. Hopefully, you're having drinks with friends and not people you don't want to be having drinks with. But you know what I mean. You're not really weighing yourself down with a bunch of food and kind of just grazing along the evening, I think, is a really cool way to do things.
Right. And it introduces that cross-pollination aspect that we talked about before, where you have people who may come in who aren't really interested in cocktails. They've heard that you have a great kitchen, and so they'll pick up a snack, and you know, the drink that they're going to order is kind of an afterthought. And then they're exposed to something that goes wonderfully with that food that they went in for. So, you know, you're kind of appealing to a whole new audience in a way.
Yeah, you know, I think about it sometimes like salt and pepper. It's like the classic idea of like, oh, just throw some salt and pepper on it. But like when it applies to drinks, it's like whenever the old mentality was, I'm just going to have this fucking drink so I can get a little drunk while I'm eating this food, I guess. It doesn't really matter. But then you realize there are hundreds of different salts and peppers out there. You know? It's not just salt and pepper. It's not just vodka and soda, you know, or whatever it may be. But yeah, I think it's a very beautiful thing. Hey, why don't we take a quick break, and when we get back, let's talk more about the beginning of the Cocktail Chronicles, Mixology Monday, and how you got to the book. Sound good?
Great.
All right, back in a moment with Paul Clark.
Bring profitability to local orchards while reviving heirloom apple varieties by cultivating awareness of craft cider. Cider Week connects cider makers from New York State and select pioneering guest cideries outside the state to buyers from top restaurants, bars, and retail shops across New York City. Those culinary tastemakers, in turn, help increase consumer awareness of cider's pleasures by hosting public events, tastings, dinners, classes, and pairings that build appreciation and demand for regional ciders.
And we're back. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, The Speakeasy. We are... Does anybody know why what's called The Speakeasy? I mean, how do you have a radio show, a talk radio show about booze and not call it The Speakeasy? I mean, it's just... It's a no-brainer. We've been doing this show for almost 5 years now, and I don't think I've ever explained that. Does it need explaining? I have no idea. I'm rambling now. Sorry about that. Paul Clark is on the radio today, and we've been talking about Imbibe Magazine, a little bit how we met, and talking about food pairings and with cocktails and just the progress of cocktail culture. But let's get back to the beginning. You have this new book called The Cocktail Chronicles, and your website, the blog that you've had for, I guess it's been 10 years now, right?
Yeah, I launched the blog in May of 2005.
Yeah, okay, so 10 years in, congratulations. That's a hell of a long time to be compiling a lot of information to put into a book. So I haven't actually, unfortunately, I haven't gotten a chance to crack it yet. But I know you well enough to know that it's a great book. And also, like, some good buddies of mine and yours, mutual friends, Meehan's had nothing but great things to say, Jim Meehan, and everyone else that I've talked to about the book has, you know, honestly, the reason why I haven't really had a chance to crack it yet is because I've just been behind the bar too damn much lately, and I don't want the pages to get wet. but that's a huge problem in our industry.
We toyed with the idea of just having the entire thing laminated for that very reason. And then there may be a use for that in the future. It's great to hear that people are enjoying it, and especially, you know, people within the industry. When I first started writing about cocktails, I mean, I didn't know really a single cocktail bartender at the time. It was, you know, it was 2005. The cocktail renaissance was still very early in its stages. It was still very New York, London-based. And here in Seattle, I just didn't know anybody personally who was doing it. So it kind of started as a way to, as me, you know, in the darkness and the wilderness, kind of, you know, wandering around with a mixing glass trying to figure out how to make an El Presidente.
Yeah.
So, you know, and when I wrote the book, it kind of seemed, you know, I'm a sucker for milestones, and I saw the 10-year anniversary coming up, and I thought, wow, I should really do something with all the stuff I'd put together early on. Because, you know, some of the drinks that I wrote about in the early years were, you know, they weren't yet commonplace on menus, and now you see them everywhere. You know, drinks like the corn and oil,
right.
The corn and oil was one, the last word was another. Drinks that weren't yet, you know, kind of commonplace, or those, you know, kind of what we think of now as staples of like a classic cocktail menu. So these were kind of, you know, me just playing around, mixing something, and, you know, coming up on that anniversary and realizing how far we've come, I thought, you know, this is a way to kind of, you know, place a timestamp, if you will, on what's happened in the last 10 years, not only with me writing about drinks, but in the drinks world overall. What has happened? What are the drinks that we've rediscovered? What are the drinks that have served to be these kind of continuing fonts of inspiration? And one of the awesome new things that have come out in the last 10 to 15 to even 20 years, I reached back into the late 20th century for some of these, that I think, you know, should be reevaluated and might actually stand a chance of being the classics of 100 years from now.
That's amazing you're saying that, because I was just thinking, while you were saying that, I was kind of thinking of the I'm trying to figure out, like it's almost like a what came first, chicken or egg kind of situation, the way that cocktail writing has progressed in the last 10 years. So, and how people make drinks, not only like at home, but like especially in the bar, and how large an effect there is from cocktail journalism in the bar world. You know, like, because 10 years ago, it was like people like yourself going to bars and learning from bartenders and reading classic cocktail books and learning about these drinks that way. And there's a lot of trial and error, because, to be honest, like, it's one of the most frustrating things in the world to me. I love reading old cocktail books, and that's how I got into this. I started buying cocktail books when I was like 12 years old, and it was weird, but I just liked them. But like, when you read these, like, late 19th century cocktail books, the format, it's almost like they were trying to invent the format of a recipe, and it didn't exist in the bar world. I mean, it didn't really so much, but when you read a cocktail spec in an old cocktail book, it might not tell you what glass it's in, or if it's supposed to be on the rocks or up, or how to garnish it. It just depends. It's totally a shot in the dark sometimes. So, that, you know, 10, 15 years ago, you absolutely had to rely on going to a bar and learning from a bartender, or you were just kind of like making up the lost parts. But now, the way that the cocktail journalism has moved along, there are, like, for instance, like, there's guys like Chris Barrett at Ludovine in Oklahoma City, who reads Imbibe and learns from it, you know, and employs those practices in his bar program. And it's just interesting the way that it's turned, like, there's more exposure to the knowledge and the information, which is really great, especially with great modern cocktail books like yours, you know?
Yeah, and, you know, part of the reason I wanted to do this, because I saw the world of drinks journalism, the world of drink books, kind of diverging in a couple of ways. Like I said, you know, I've been collecting a lot of those vintage cocktail guides for years, and those were really kind of, you know, some of my first sources of inspiration. And a lot of those, as you said, were really kind of, you know, difficult to dig through in some ways. You know, there would be, you know, you'd go through a drinks recipe and it would call for the juice of half a lime. Well, how much is that?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, a lot of the, you know, a lot of things just were not spelled out or non-specific, or some things were just weird. So I wanted to sit down and kind of, you know, look at some of the books that had most influenced me, something like David Embury's Fine Art of Mixing Drinks, and what would a book like that look like today? Or what would, you know, another great book that is much more contemporary was Esquire Drinks from Dave Wandridge, which was, you know, probably the first book that I picked up that really kind of excited my imagination. What would that book look like today after all of the innovation and all of the development that's gone on in cocktails over the past 10 years? But similarly, I also wanted to look into the future and think, okay, you know, we have a number of books now that are increasingly written for the specialist, written for people within the industry who have access to a lot of tools, to this vast array of spirits at their disposal to make these drinks. How can I simplify that? How can I make something that's easily accessible to the beginner, but is also, you know, a historical document in some ways of the way people are drinking now?
I think it's, you know, to me, there's... It's kind of like it's always like that hard balance, you know. And I think especially, well, there've been a lot of books that have come out recently. just saying, and a lot of really good ones. And I think that's a really great thing. I think that it is actually. It's a great sign of like where we're at. Like you were saying, I guess what my point is with this is that it is really interesting to see where we are as a drinking culture nowadays. It's supposed to even like, you know, 10 years ago, like when Esquire books came or when Esquire cocktails came out, you know, I'm not going to say that that's an antiquated book because it's a very good book, but it's just interesting to see, like you said, putting these timestamps on. You know, like Jeffrey Morgenthaler's book is a good example of kind of more of a bartender's manual, you know, a technical manual in a lot of ways. But then you've got, say, like Greg Sider's book also is very technical. But then you have certain books that come out that are, you know, like Charles H. Baker's books, you know, they're always really playful and fun to read. And I mean, he was like a writer first and then kind of a barman second. So it really appealed to like the mass market. It's really hard to find that balance, I think. I've not found it. And not even with this show that we're on right now. It's very difficult. But, you know, knowing from your reading, you have a really good way about putting things in perspective and making them very easy to understand, but entertaining and educational at the same time.
Which yeah, you know, I mean, it's interesting that you brought up Charles H. Baker, because that's another, you know, I hold him on the same level as David Embury in terms of an influence in what I've done, not only because they were both interesting writers or put things out there, but also neither of them were professional bartenders, and neither am I. And so it was looking at it from that side of the spectrum. But also, as you mentioned, you know, Charles H. Baker, you pick it up for the writing first and for the recipe second. And, you know, recipes on their own are dull as dirt to read sometimes. And so, you know, I make my living as a writer, and I make my living in the world of words. And so I wanted to have the book really deliver on that front and really put the writing front and center, but the recipes have to stand up as well. So I'm trying to draw from, you know, the selection of drinks and what we've learned now and what we've picked up along the way, but also make that approachable and entertaining for the first timer. You know, if we make every drinks book cocktail guide on the same level as like a cookbook from Ferran Adria or from Thomas Keller, then it's going to become impenetrable to the newcomers.
Sure.
To understand this. So, I mean, in a way, I wanted almost the joy of cooking approach, you know, something where you can pick it up. If you've never mixed a drink for yourself before, you can look at this and maybe work your way through a Manhattan.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. If you think about the cocktail, any cocktail you're having, And you think about the experience and the atmosphere, the environment, the people around. It's that cocktail moment has a lot of soul. So you have to put the soul into the writing. If you're reading about it, it's when you read Hemingway, you know, he talks about a lot of things. But then you realize, like, when you're flipping through the pages, like, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you have a glass of brandy in your hand, and you're like, where the fuck did that come from? You know, it engages you and puts you in that position, that puts you in that situation of what it is to enjoy a cocktail and enjoy the environment and the experience. And yeah, I mean, like, I first got into reading cocktail books because I visually liked the way that, like, I like format. I mean, I was a graphic designer, and I liked the way that a recipe looked, even though some of them didn't look that great. But I didn't know what the hell Curacao was, or Curacao, or whatever I called it back then.
Right.
But I was like, I was intrigued by that and the backstory of these cocktails. You know, learning about where margarita came from, which no one really knows, but I like the lore surrounding it. You know, and there's a lot of storytelling that goes along with cocktail books, and that's the same thing. Like, you can get some of that experience at home, but like when you're in a bar and you're listening to a bartender tell you, you know, you get someone like Del DeGroff start spinning stories, and it turns into a completely different experience, you know. And then you have this personal experiential connection with the cocktail, and then it has soul at that point. And I think that's how a cocktail book or any cocktail writing should be. It should have soul.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's, you know, the drink is just the kind of skeleton upon which I can hang things. The real flesh and the real life that comes into it is from the people that you're encountering in there, from the bartenders that you're talking to, from the people we meet on the other side of the bar. We're there for the pure enjoyment of it and for the joy of being around other people and enjoying cocktails. And so, you know, it's that interesting mesh, and that's what's always interested me and what's kept me going back to this for so long, is that interesting mix of craftsmanship in some ways, but also the personalities and the life that really comes with the full experience.
I couldn't agree more, my friend. you know, I'm really sorry that you couldn't be here today, but I know I'm going to see you soon. It's always great talking with you. We're unfortunately at the end of the show. I know you and I could talk shop for quite a while.
Absolutely. But well, I wish I could be there too, and thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Great talking with you. The book, everyone, is called The Cocktail Chronicles, Navigating the Cocktail Renaissance with Jigger, Shaker, and Glass. It's put out by Springhouse Press. You can find it in whatever your favorite bookstore is, I'm sure. And you can also get it on Amazon. You get it on the Cocktail Chronicles website. And, of course, if you don't already read Imbibe Magazine, I can't imagine any of the listeners of this show not reading Imbibe Magazine. If you don't, you should definitely get a subscription because it's great. It's the best drinks magazine out there. And thanks again, Paul. It's really good talking with you, and I wish you all the best, and see you soon.
Thanks so much, Damon.
All right. Cheers, guys. That's it for the Speakeasy this week. Tune in to Heritage Radio Network for many, many other programs just like this one. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.